Welcome back to another episode of the Back Row Super Show.
Yep, this is the book club episode where we're going to be talking about a book of our choosing.
Yep.
To kind of make sure you guys are reading your books.
That's right. And just for posterity's sake, I'm Stuart.
I'm Zach.
And the book that we are reading or discussing is World War Z.
Yep, this was my choice. This is by Max Brooks, who is Mel Brooks' son.
That's right.
He wrote the, before this, he wrote the Zombie Survival Handbook,
I think. Which really isn't a narrative story.
Yeah.
It was more of just a survivor's guide if the zombie apocalypse happened.
Yeah, it looks, it's laid out like one of those, like, you can find on survivalist websites and maybe even Amazon, like, the SAS handbook to, like, surviving in the wilderness. And so it was kind of written as a how to survive the zombie apocalypse. There's actually good information in there. Like, don't wear your hair long.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, finding high ground because zombies can't climb. Now, this book was published probably during the beginning of the quote-unquote zombie craze.
Yeah, so this came out in 2006.
Mm-hmm. This was before The Walking Dead was popular. Yeah. This was before a lot of the newer movies came out.
Yeah, this is kind of the first little, like, peak in zombies being kind of like a mainstream interest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the book is subtitled An Oral History of the Zombie War. So, again, this will be spoilers because we're assuming you guys have read this.
Yeah.
But it's laid out, as it says, as an oral history. The inspiration from the book, as far as I've been able to tell, was I did not write down the name of the book, but it's a book by Studs Terkel after World War II, I believe, where he was speaking with just random citizens, former officials, stuff like that, just kind of maintain a sense of narrative to what the regular people were experiencing during a world war.
Yeah, and you can definitely see that influence in this book. Yeah. Now, a question for you, Zach. Did you read this book before the movie came out or after the movie came out? Because this book also is a movie that came out in, I believe,
2013.
13, yeah.
Yeah. I read it before seeing the movie. I think I read it in 2009 or 2010.
Okay.
I had a coworker at where I was working who was just like, "Yeah, this is really good," and he's kind of like a World War II buff.
Oh.
And he's like, "Yeah, no, it's based off this book and whatever," and kind of told me the backstory behind it. And so I borrowed it from him and was like, "Oh, this is kind of interesting."
Yeah. I also read the book before the movie came out, and then to prepare for this podcast, I reread it a second time.
Yeah,
so here. I kind of had two interesting views of the book previous to the movie and then post the movie. So.
Yeah, yeah, and at the end, maybe we can talk about the movie a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't have extensive notes on it, just my memory.
Yeah, I only saw it once, and I think I was on a plane.
Oh, okay.
So I don't have a good
grasp of the
movie, yeah. But
oh, so and again, the way this book is laid out makes it kind of difficult to talk directly about what happens because it's made up of obviously fake interviews.
Yeah, sort of like short stories.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of a collection of short stories, kind of like The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury.
Mm-hmm.
But the author has kind of structured things so that they all have all the stories have a theme.
Yeah.
So we'll just be going through the different sections that the author has outlined, and I have some notes on some standout stories. There's some we're not covering because they're a little bit more nuanced and kind of fit in between certain stories, but I just wanted to focus on a couple from each section or a few from each section that I feel like sums up that section.
Yeah, best. And again, all of these stories were taken chronologically, so it really does kind of build up that narrative of what happened. With the beginning stories kind of the beginning of the outbreak. where people were confused about what was happening.
Exactly.
They didn't actually know that it was a zombie, like, epidemic. They thought it was, like, another virus.
Yeah.
Though, kind of thinking about it in the real world, I think we would nail if zombies were, like, an actual disease. Like, oh, those are a bunch of zombies because we've seen it on TV now.
Well, I know, like, maybe, God, it was probably 10 years ago at this point. The CDC, I think, put out, like, a steps they would take in the event of a zombie outbreak.
Yeah.
Like, and an emergency plan like they have.
And it's kind of funny because, you know, we have more bullets, like, in the world than people.
Yeah, that's not surprising.
Yeah. So, and if you're thinking, and these zombies seem to be, like, your standard zombies. They weren't, like, any rage zombies.
Yeah, they're not runners. They're just kind of the George Romero, like, shuffling. And this is in the book. But in the book, they're kind of described as, you know, just the shuffling mass of undead that you'd see in, like, Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, yeah. Where there's nothing, like, special about these zombies. There's no, like, unique zombies or anything like that. They're pretty much standard zombies that you'd see from, like, Walking Dead or George Romero.
Right, right. So, yeah, I guess the first section that I wanted to look at was the introduction, obviously. It's just 4 pages. I think the introduction should be looked at a little bit more closely because there's a lot of good world building in there.
Yeah.
And it's even written in a way that it sounds like a historical document.
Yeah.
You know, and by that I mean that the author references things without too much description, and there's a right amount of vagueness in there to make it seem real. Like, yeah. I feel like if you were reading a book about, you know, 9/11 and the World Trade Center, like, that's such a big moment.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that you can kind of glide over if you're trying to get people's stories because people know generally what happened.
Yeah. I will say, as Max Brooks', I guess, first narrative book, he did well with his writing style and his world building.
Yeah.
I feel like it's probably a more simpler book to read. He doesn't use a lot of technical terms. He keeps a lot of the language very basic, I would say.
Yeah.
I guess that's a little bit easier for folks to access because they're not, like, having to look up words or looking up what the technical reference is. He definitely does keep it simple.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, for some other stories, he does kind of, like, spice it up a little bit with technical terms. But yeah, I do feel like this book is very accessible for people.
Yeah. The very first section, like you were alluding to, though, the first proper section is warnings. It's 52 pages.
Yes.
I don't know how many stories there are in it, but the very first one is set in the United Federation of China. And, you know, buckle in, these stories vary wildly in their location bases because the kind of meta-narrative for the book that I've seen is that the fake author of this text is kind of a war reporter, kind of maybe a UN collaborator, getting people's stories. So, you know, the author has access to being able to globetrot and just get information from people to kind of restore, kind of keep this maintained for posterity.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because I've felt like there was a bit of similarity to another book that we read, Beowulf, where there's a narrative who's basically writing as well.
Yeah.
Though I believe that there weren't any, like, footnotes or anything in this
Yeah, book. There's no, like, references to other works or anything.
Yeah. So, again, it kind of keeps it pretty simple.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, but the first story, United Federation of China, it kind of chronicles the first outbreak. It's told from the perspective of a doctor who gets called into this remote area in China.
Yeah.
And then the military shows up and stifles everything.
Yeah, and again, this doctor doesn't have a good understanding of what's happening.
Yeah.
he's not triggered, oh, zombie outbreak. He just thinks that it's a disease of some sort.
Yeah, and it is a remote area of China, so he's having to travel a long way to get there because it's, you know, there's large sections of China that, for all intents and purposes, are still set in 1900. So the doctor has to come to you a mm-hmm. lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
The next one, I really liked the bit where it's set in Lhasa, I guess, in the People's Republic of Tibet.
Yeah.
Talking with a smuggler.
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed that one, too.
Yeah, yeah, that the smuggler smuggles actual people in and out of borders.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting statement that he makes that, you know, every rich man's house has a servant's entrance, and he's referring to being able to get people into Western Europe via Eastern Europe, because yeah. that's where a lot of the labor and kind of domestic class people come from.
Mm-hmm.
You can get people into the U.S. via Mexico is another thing that he says.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting talking to it, having a smuggler be like the second person that he speaks to, and is like, yeah, there's this horrible thing going down, and countries are getting locked up, but like, we can still get people in.
Yeah. And it kind of gives a his perspective is of, I guess, an illegal person, where
yeah.
he's at liberty to speak more freely. Because with some of these stories, when he's talking to, like, the military folks and whatnot, you can tell that they are a little reserved in what they're willing to tell him as a reporter.
Yeah, exactly. Because he's collecting information that's being preserved, there's a little bit more, like, I'm just going to give you what I think I'm cleared to give you.
Yeah, or there could be, like, biases, because I remember there was a, well, we'll get to it further in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So next section I wanted to talk about was in Meteoric Greece.
Mm-hmm.
He's speaking with a Canadian soldier, and he's talking about drug busts in Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah.
The last story via the smuggler ended with a truck of people going to Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to me to see that there was still some sort of police effort going on for things that are not related to the zombie outbreak, that, you know, like 2 or 3 weeks later, people aren't going to worry about drug busts. Like,
yeah.
They're not going to give a shit if you...
Well, and it's, again, it kind of goes, I don't know, back to, like, Watchmen, where if you have a giant problem, people start banding together and forgetting about their small little quibbles or things that they've been fighting about to sort of combat this greater evil.
Yeah.
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 Which you kind of see as the book progresses, that people start banding together. And I would like to think that, you know, humanity would sort of rise to the occasion.
Yeah, humanity would win over inhumanity.
Yeah, where, yeah. you know, people would be more willing to help out than to, like, loot and take and whatnot.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. The next one that I wanted to speak about, at least, was set in the Amazon rainforest in mm-hmm. Brazil, focusing on a doctor telling a story about how a donor heart was infected and then covered up.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because, again, the doctor's from Brazil, so, you know, there's some question as to whether this heart was obtained legally or illegally,
yeah.
and it's heavily implied that it was illegally.
Yeah, and it's just kind of an interesting concept of, like, the disease being transferred, because... Yeah.
You don't have to be bit. Like, you can be having an organ transplant
yeah.
and just turn into a zombie. Yeah.
And I'm not sure any of the literature that I've digested with zombies has really explored that concept. So I thought it was very unique, a very unique idea that Max Brooks came up with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next up is Tel Aviv, Israel. Mm-hmm. He's speaking with a former spy. He's a cool intelligence agent. I like the inclusion of that character because it's kind of an overview of the things that have happened in the previous stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the intelligence agent has this bird's eye view of, yeah, this is the thing, this is what we were observing. We didn't know how to put any of it together because how do you put this together?
Yeah. And again, you have to kind of suspend your disbelief because you think that this is a world that has not dealt with zombies in, yeah, like, a media or anything along those lines.
Yeah, you always have to raise that curtain or whatever of disbelief whenever you deal with zombies where no one has seen Night of the Living Dead, yeah, no one has seen Dawn of the Dead, any of that.
Yeah, where it's not part of media.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the other thing that Max Brooks does with this, because I have a note here that I like the character of the disaffected old spy who's just kind of world weary.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Brooks does a very good job of writing in different voices for this book. Like, all the characters seem believable enough given what they do.
Yeah, it seems like everybody kind of brings their own unique spin, sure, to this story.
Yeah.
And that's definitely difficult, like, making each person feel unique. Though I would argue that in the middle of the book, when they're kind of dealing with things, it kind of gets a little samey with the,
yeah, it does. A lot of stories are repeated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, we'll talk about that when we get to that.
Yeah, yeah. And then the last one in this section I wanted to talk about was set in Bethlehem and Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
There is a... The subject this time is an older man. He's a professor, so you're probably middle age. And he's recounting when he was a younger man, taken, mm-hmm, into Israel as a repatriated Palestinian.
Yeah.
Because what he's referring to in here is when... In the fake chronology of events, Israel started pulling in people to basically keep people safe.
Yeah.
And I like him reflecting on his younger, like, revolutionary self.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing in the story that he recounts when he realizes that everything has changed, borders don't mean anything anymore.
Yeah.
It's just whether or not you're safe, because he sees... An IDF person basically sacrificed themselves to keep a bunch of refugees safe.
Because, yeah,
again, like you were saying, it's humanity versus inhumanity.
Yeah, and I think that this story was a kind of a refreshing story as well.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't as much focused on, oh, this disease, what is this? It's, again, him recounting his previous experience and how it's kind of very similar to what's happening right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the next section is titled Blame. Mm-hmm. It's 28 pages. There's not very many stories in this one because they do tend to be longer,
yes,
sections.
Yeah.
The first one in it is set in Langley, Virginia. And he's speaking with the former CIA director.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I liked this one is that the character brings up interesting points about the CIA not really being able to defend itself in terms of optics in the grand scheme of things, because,
yeah,
to do so, they'd have to break vows of national security officers, which you can't defend yourself by referring to things that are classified, but just because you're being painted in a bad light.
Yeah. And I also enjoyed this story as well.
Yeah.
Because it kind of harps on a lot of things that have happened in our history where, yeah, people want to do the right thing, but there's so much red tape that you have to kind of get through that so I was talking with a friend and we both kind of agreed that, if America's prepared for, like, trouble or for a crisis, we're good at dealing with that.
Yeah.
But, like, dealing with a crisis urgently, I don't think we're really set up for that kind of,
yeah,
situation, just because it takes a lot of steps to get to a point where you can start reacting to that crisis.
Yeah.
Where firing missiles basically take so many steps of people okaying it, where it's going to take
You can't just turn a key and be like, okay, guess we're firing all these missiles. Like, there's several layers of approval.
Yeah. So, I felt like this story was true to real life.
Well, and this character brings up a lot of things that are true today.
Mm-hmm.
He refers to the brain drain effect in government. What that refers to is losing your best and brightest people to private sector jobs, because private sector jobs pay way more than public service jobs, which CIA is still a public service job.
Yeah, and you don't have to deal with the bullshit politics, too.
Yeah, like, if you're good, you can basically set up your own office, write your own check, you know.
Yeah.
Determine your own rules. I did find it funny that in the book there's a report called the Warmbrun Knight Report that outlines the threats of this kind of zombie invasion or whatever. And he mentions that somehow, the eyes only copy of this report that was supposed to go to him as director of the CIA somehow ended up in a file clerk's desk in San Antonio, Texas, FBI's office.
Yeah.
Which is funny, because, like, what that tells me is that some clerk was like, oh, this is a joke, whatever. And it got intercepted somehow by another office and then just shoved in a drawer somewhere and wasn't found until way too late.
Yeah.
Or
it just kind of shows, like, the bureaucracy.
Bureaucracy of
just, like,
public service.
Yeah, where we're all humans. We've all made mistakes. Maybe something happened where this didn't get to the person that needed that information.
Yeah. Now the next section in Blame is set in Finland. The character in this one is a Supreme Allied Commander.
Mm-hmm.
I find it a really cool detail that they talk about every thaw that Finland has to be cleared of zombies, because these zombies in this story, they just freeze when they get too cold. And so in Finland, when the spring and summer hit, they unfreeze, and so these people have to go out and clear these fields of zombies.
Where they're kind of, like, in stasis.
Well, and I feel like Brooks did a very good job of painting this character as, like, a soldier that feels like he didn't do his job to the best of his ability.
Yeah.
There's, like, remorse in this character's retelling of events and talking about the current day situation in the story. Let's see. So the next one is set at Vostok Station in Antarctica. There we go. the character is a businessman. He bought a Russian research station and lives in it. He's kind of a survivalist guy.
Yeah.
He just, no bones about it, he is a slimebag profiteer. He's profiting off people's fears. He takes no responsibility, and he's super narcissistic. Like, he makes the statement, I stopped the recession by selling these cheap, flimsy, like, go bags, pretty much, to people who thought that they would work.
Didn't actually work, yeah.
No, yeah. I kind of feel like this character, because this book came out in 06, and it was kind of still recent in people's memory, I feel like this character's commentary of, like, post 9/11 prepper businesses that sprang up, where they're like, "Here's your $5,000 gas mask
for the attack happens."
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, but I mean, gas masks filter, like, it depends on what the filter is that they'll filter through.
Yeah,
like, you don't.
I do think that it was a social commentary on some of the people who are just making profit.
Yeah,
But I do feel like it was an important character to sort of highlight, just because not all of us are going to be good Samaritans when crisis hit. Usually when crises do hit, that there are opportunities to make money, and people like that do exist.
Yeah. So the Amarillo, Texas section focuses on a former chief of staff. I kind of think it's funny that he's literally shoveling horse shit. He's offensive and ignorant. He's kind of a willfully ignorant career politician.
Yeah, which, you know, there's plenty of.
Yeah, but, like, his section basically shifts all of the blame onto other people.
Yeah, other countries. And
makes me wonder if it's showing the political response to a global catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that's realistic? Like, do you feel like people would tend to, like, shove a bunch of blame elsewhere?
Yeah, because it's really kind of hard for people to take the blame and be like, oh, I was responsible for this, let me fix this.
Yeah.
And again, it's the whole politics, too, of I don't want to take the whole brunt of this, let me kind of divvy out the blame to other folks.
Yeah.
Which, you know, can be justified at certain times, but there are times of just you taking the blame and trying to fix the situation where I do feel like this book kind of highlights where it's like, oh, this is happening, we need to sort of band together and solve this crisis.
Yeah.
And I do believe, well, we'll get to that later, but, you know, I would be interested to hear of your thoughts if this actually happened, what would happen?
Okay. Yeah, we can talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last section in this is focused on Troy Montana,
which is a fantastic name. Troy
Montana. Oh, yeah, that's the place. A funny place, or a funny name.
Yeah.
But the character in it is an architect and the mayor of zombie-proof housing facilities. They're basically houses on stilts.
Yeah.
Made out of metal. Which is pretty ingenious, but...
Well, it's also interesting that Max Brook uses a lot of his... tips in his zombie survival guide.
Oh yeah, he does.
In this book. when we get to the section where they're dealing with it, a lot of those tips come into play.
Yeah.
One of his tips is getting to a higher ground or being somewhere where there's like a ladder or something along those lines, since zombies aren't really dexterous or can like climb well. So
yeah,
it's interesting to see that book bleed into this.
Yeah. Yeah, and I kind of like that the architect is a suburban mom, and the story of her ripping that thing's head off,
yeah,
like to protect her family, herself. I guess that she's in the blame section because she's kind of like an entrepreneur that's come out of this successfully, mm-hmm. and so she's more willing to put a lot of blame on the people in charge.
Yeah, she does come out and say, you know, the government didn't really do much, that the private sector kind of had to step in and sort of make a profit, but, you know, help out people by making this product available to them.
Yeah. The next section is The Great Panic. It's mm-hmm. 47 pages, and it focuses on evacuations that happened in different areas.
Yeah.
The first one's set at a National Guard base in Memphis, Tennessee. They bring up the crowd control experiment, which I think it's funny that this is one of the first ones, if not the first one, in the section, because they bring up the experiment where if you line up people in front of a building, a line will just kind of naturally form behind them.
Yeah.
Because... people want to see what's going on. And so, like, in an evacuation situation, that's not good. You don't want a lot of people showing up when you can't handle
them. Yeah.
That was it for that one. Alang, India, focuses on an IT guy who goes to a port city because he figures he can get out at a port.
Yeah.
But it's a ship graveyard. There's nothing that goes out. Everything just goes in and ships get dismantled in it. Which is kind of funny that someone in because, I mean, I wouldn't know which port to go to or which port did that versus sets outbound courses.
Yeah.
I'm not an IT professional, but, like, he's still a citizen of that country, but, like, he goes to the wrong port because it's just...
No.
Yeah, we know that there's a port. That's about it.
Which is kind of funny because, again, Max Brooks takes from his previous book about... going on boats, where you're safe on a boat until your food or supplies run out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in, let's see, Topeka, Kansas, the Feral Children Rehabilitation Center. Again, this is a really cool tidbit of world building where there are kids that were just out in the wilderness.
Yeah, where their parents had been killed or turned or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And they're just surviving on their own and they're feral.
Yeah. Yeah, they're just completely feral. They have to be reintegrated into society. Maybe it's psychological trauma that makes them this way. But yeah, maybe it's just because their parents were killed, like you said, and so they had to fend for themselves.
And, yeah, again, what you were saying, I like it because it's world building. Was it necessary for the story? No, but it was a really cool sort of world building where you get to see what's happening after all of this stuff has gone down.
Yeah, yeah. So then we go to Ice City, Greenland. The character in this is a former Iranian Revolution Guard.
Mm-hmm.
His section's interesting because he talks about the breakdown of diplomatic talks. So, like, there's a bridge destroyed, border stations are attacked, and there's no one to tell the other side to stop. This isn't us attacking you.
Yeah.
This is something else entirely.
Yeah, which would be interesting because I guess countries would start thinking like this was a planned attack or a planned disease to either try to bring down their country or something along those lines. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, especially if you're in an area. Well, and it goes back to the professor that was speaking about being a repatriated Palestinian. If you grow up in a culture where there's always an us versus them and, like, mortal enemies,
mm-hmm.
of course you're going to assume you're being attacked because your entire life, you're right. It's like America during the Cold War. If we were attacked, immediately assume that it's Russia.
Because that's what you've been told. That's what, you know.
Exactly.
The propaganda basically has been telling you.
Yeah. 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 And then the last one I wanted to focus on in the evacuation section is in Denver, Colorado,
mm-hmm.
Where the guy talks about just general military fuck-ups. He says that shock and awe can't affect the zombies, whereas, you know, the U.S. military's might has always been shock and awe. Just overwhelm the senses of people, and they'll stop fighting because we're so much stronger.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of that, like, rattlesnake approach of we've got a huge army, don't mess with us because we are willing to use that or something.
Yeah. Well, and I especially like this in the first kind of section where it's talking about, like, the Great Panic.
Mm-hmm.
Because he mentions that they have a thermobaric weapon that I believe is real.
Hmm.
But it... The sudden change in pressure will suck the lungs out of your mouth.
Yeah.
So you're just walking around with your lungs hanging out of your face.
Yeah.
Doesn't affect zombies. Like, they're just going to still continue. So like, yeah, it's, again, goes back to military fuck-ups where it's like, oh, these weapons are designed for a specific thing.
Yeah.
They don't really work outside of that. He talks about the Battle of Yonkers,
mm-hmm.
and then he references something called the South African Plan, which we'll get into in a second.
Yep.
Did you want to talk about the Battle of Yonkers?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely an interesting sort of experience, what he was writing about. Again, I feel we have all of this, like, military power, and I know at the very beginning... It would be confusing.
Chaos.
Yes. where you're not exactly sure what to do. And again, this is in a world that doesn't know about zombies, because I feel like if any of our military folks out there would see a zombie, they'd be like, oh, shoot for the head. Take them down.
Yep.
Where this one is kind of just a fuck-up because they don't know exactly what they're doing, and then lines of communication get breakdown, and then you're just kind of, like, stranded out there.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, they're doing the thing that everyone tells you to do, aim for center mass.
Yeah. Yeah.
Zombies don't care.
Yeah.
They'll just get back up and keep coming.
But it is interesting just sort of, like, knowing these particular rations and then knowing that you're going to be running out of supplies because this is an endless horde of people.
So that's the last section in the evacuations. Mm-hmm. Turning the Tide is the next section. It's 39 pages. It's set in Robben Island in Cape Town. And it brings up what the previous story soldier said was the South African plan.
Yeah.
Called the Redeker plan. And it's cold, but
yeah,
it's effective. Basically, the Redeker plan is predicated on the knowledge that there's no possible way to save everyone in your country.
Yeah.
So what you do is a partial evacuation. And then that way you have human bait so that the real evacuees can be safe.
Yeah, it's rough, and it's...
I feel like that's realistic, though. I feel I feel like people who are essential because of either job or position and power or whatever, they're going to get evacuated first.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is, like, with the Cold War and with the threat of nuclear attacks,
yeah,
a lot of essential personnel had accesses to bunkers.
Yeah, well, I mean, we still have that. It's called a designated survivor. So, like, during things like the State of the Union address, to maintain some level of chain of authority, if someone were to, say, attack Congress or during the State of the Union, there are people who are designated survivors who are literally not present and away. I don't know if they're probably housed in a bunker for a few hours while they do the State of the Union and then they're let out.
Yeah,
just to maintain a chain of command.
So, I definitely see that this is, you know, something that would be a real-world practice.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's rough because you want to save everybody, but then people have that mindset of, like, you gotta sacrifice a few to save
the majority.
Yeah.
And the really kind of chilling thing for me at the end of this is that at the end of the story, there's the reveal that, Paul Redeker, the guy that came up with the plan, is actually the narrator that he's speaking to.
Yeah.
And it's set in a psychiatric institution.
Yeah.
So obviously the insinuation is that he came up with the plan, but it traumatized him so much to see it enacted that he disassociated himself. Like, he did not refer to himself as Paul Redeker. He referred to himself as this completely different guy who's a historian of this Paul Redeker figure.
It's just that guilt that eats away from you.
And so he disassociated to keep from going crazy.
Yeah. And again, I think that's a very interesting, like, writing style.
Yeah.
And it kind of surprises me a little bit just because Max Brooks hasn't really written much.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if he, like, had some sort of, I don't know, person advising him on writing or something along those lines, but I couldn't find any information about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's only put out these two books. Mm-hmm. This and the Zombie Survival Handbook were kind of runaway successes for him, so I wouldn't be surprised if, like, he made his bank and is just like, okay, I don't need anything else. I don't need to do anything.
Again, he's the son of Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
So he probably had money to spare.
No, sure. Yeah. So next section is in Armagh, Ireland. Ireland. whenever they Romanized Celtic words, whoever did a really piss poor job. So there's really, that it could just be pronounced Arna.
Who
knows?
I wasn't going to try to guess at that.
Yeah. So this one focuses on someone who was part of the Procnow plan, which is mentioned, and it's basically, I think the footnote on it says that it's the German version of the Redeker plan.
Yeah.
Like, it's similar enough that, I mean, just, like, not referencing anything, but, like, a subtitle type thing, just saying this is what the Procnow plan was. And it focuses on a survivor of the human bait in the plan, which is kind of fucked up, but, you know, it's still interesting.
It is, yeah. And it's interesting that, multiple, countries were basically coming to the same conclusion.
Yeah, like, you have to have bait and then evacuate your real people.
Yeah.
Not real people, but you know what I mean. Like, the real evacuees. Yeah. Like, there have to be two different sections of who's being served.
Yeah.
Manitoba, Canada focuses on parents who were evacuated, hit the road, and the narrator tells the story of picking up a hitchhiker when she was a little girl, when her parents were evacuated.
Mm-hmm.
And waking up without the person in the car because the parents left the hitchhiker to die. Because I forget why now exactly. I should have written it down. I
believe it was because of supplies.
Because of supplies, or maybe the parents got a weird vibe or whatever. But yeah, like, the narrator, who is an adult now, talking about being a little girl and her parents leaving someone behind is kind of chilling.
It is. I mean, because it gives you that idea that you had to make those hard decisions. Like,
yeah.
You had only so much resources available, and yes, at the beginning of this, we were talking about you want humanity to overcome, but sometimes there was those hard decisions of, I don't have enough to help this person.
Just going to have to take care of our kid and us, and that's it.
Yeah.
Apparently the parents' plan, which was successful, was to go north where the zombies would freeze, because that wasn't a known quantity then, but it was suspected, I'm guessing, in the world.
Yeah, and it was sort of spreading like wildfire of that knowledge that zombies would actually freeze.
Yeah. And then the last one that I wanted to talk about is set in Rajasthan, India.
Mm-hmm.
Focuses on a former person in the Border Roads organization. And he talks about their version of the plan was to blow up roads and bridges, literally to keep refugees and the undead out.
Yeah.
Just seal yourself in, which doesn't seem like a great plan, but...
Yeah.
You know.
I guess when you're desperate, you make desperate moves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Homefront USA, 60 mm-hmm. pages.
Yep.
And I know that we're moving kind of at a breakneck speed, but like this book is so chaotic at times because of how it's supposed to be written.
Yeah. And again, you know, we are skipping over a couple of stories here and there.
Yeah. Just because there's either nuance or it's reiterating a point present in one of the other stories.
Yeah.
This one starts off in Taos, New Mexico, mm-hmm. Department of Strategic Resources, which I thought was interesting. It follows a guy who's kind of the director of the Department of Strategic Resources.
Yeah.
And they talk about how they need people to rebuild. Because executives, quote unquote, and consultants... or 65% of the workforce, a lot of them are useless.
Yeah.
Like, the people who in the previous iteration of society were held in high regard because of the amount of money they made, nothing they did was practical, and so none of it actually helps. And he talks about needing engineers, craftsmen, and they don't have many that survived because of their nature of kind of being, like, out amongst, like, on a site. And so they're at high-risk environments.
Mm-hmm. And, excuse me, you kind of get that feeling where they were sacrificing a lot of people. A lot of these sacrificed people were unemployed or underpaid people who kind of had those skills, who were those tradesmen, who were these, like, craftsmen, who would actually be useful at that, since most of these, like, consultants didn't want to dirty their hands building roads and things along those lines.
Yeah. And the character makes the point that commuter-based infrastructure is useless for people in the suburbs. And then also blue-collar people in cities have a less chance of living because of the saturation of people.
Yeah.
Which... you know, screws you at both ends.
Yeah, kind of. You have to be in that sweet spot.
Yeah. No. Well, and I like his reason for why Marines were the most creative and resourceful people to have in his office. It's because they procure their equipment from the Navy, their equipment budget, but admirals aren't interested in a land war.
Yeah.
So they just kind of have to make do and figure out how to make things work.
Exactly. I mean, it's that whole thing about living on a boat. You know, most of them have been living on, like, aircraft carriers and things along those lines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So next up is Burlington, Vermont. We talk with someone who makes a statement that the quote-unquote Rebs are the biggest threat to national security, more so than the Fundies or the Greenies.
Yeah.
Which, again, is a neat little world-building thing.
Yeah, you get your slang.
Yeah, you get your slang, but, like, Fundies are probably, you know, evangelicals who are, like, think it's the end times.
Yeah.
Greenies are probably tree huggers. And probably. Rebs, obviously, are the people that are survivalists now, can't wait to break from the government,
yeah,
blah, blah, blah. I find it interesting that the narrator says that they can see their point, though. And based on how it's worded in here, isolated communities, like in Appalachia, for example, were deserted by the U.S., like, in the time of emergency. Like, the U.S., in this fake history world, focused on larger population cities, and so they didn't worry about the people in...
Yeah, in rural Appalachian hills and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, I know a couple of friends who would kind of be excited at the idea of this, like...
Yeah, I try to cut ties with those people. just because, like, if you're not in it for, like, to be with everyone, then why are you still around? Like,
But boy, do they love posting on Facebook.
They love posting on Facebook. They love having their guns. Next up is Wenatchee, Washington. They talk about Quislings, which are humans who think they've died, and so they act like zombies.
Yeah, which is kind of an interesting, like, really psychological... yeah, where it's like, oh, I'm just going to act like a zombie now. Or
yeah.
Yeah, where I guess it's a coping mechanism?
Yeah, I would assume so, that it's just to cope with the horrific things that you have seen.
Yeah, because, I mean, none of us have gone through a crisis like this,
sure,
but I'm sure it would affect us in many different ways, and this is definitely a possibility that I could see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the last one in this section would be, is set in Malibu, California, and it's talking about propaganda movies, highlighting weapons that the government can't use for resource reasons, but they do inspire hope in people.
Yeah.
So, like, they focus on a basically a microwave gun that makes things burst. And the guy's like, yeah, but, like, firing it is so ineffectual that, like, I mean, yeah,
the
it'll
cost
work.
Effect, yeah.
But, like, you've got to power it, and then you've got to recharge it. And then
thousands
like,
of dollars.
It's useless, but if you can catch it being used on film, you can use it as propaganda to make people feel like nothing bad is happening.
Yeah.
Or the tide is being turned.
Yeah. It's sort of like the stay calm and carry on propaganda of like, you know, everything will be okay soon.
Yeah.
Because of this great technology. Look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the next section is titled Around the World and Above. It's 101 pages. I think it's the thickest.
It's the beefiest, yeah.
Yeah. So, first one is set in Bohemia in the European Union. And the narrator talks about castles as being perfect for defense. Not only in olden times, but again with zombies.
I mean, it makes sense. Having a moat.
Yeah, and like the narrator is described by the in-book author as being an expert with the claymore and walking around with a claymore on his back.
Yeah.
And then, you know, to go back to the Department of Strategic Resources, the U.S. apparently had something called the lobotomizer made by Detres.
Yeah.
Which the Marines came up with, which again is a cool little like shovel type thing that you can use to
use, just kill. Yeah.
Yeah. Just kill them and keep them away. And you're not making any noise really.
Yeah, because, again, it goes back to that whole, like, managing zombies and managing resources and things along those lines. Even though I feel like if it happened nowadays, we have just so much ammo and, like, guns and stuff like that, that
yeah,
it would be kind of easy once the initial panic happened of destroying zombies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next section. I only have four in this section, even though it's the biggest, but yeah. I feel like there's the coolest world building in this section.
Yeah.
I
mean, there's one section that kind of, I feel, was a little ham-handed.
Yeah.
A bit. With the one in Japan.
Yeah, which I'll talk about in a second. But yeah, so this next one is the DMZ in South Korea, where an intelligence officer is saying that North Korea is honestly the most ideal spot in the world for survival, because of the population's loyalty. Intelligence can't really use spies and vice versa.
Yeah.
Which apparently, yeah, like you have this section where he's talking about, yeah, the North Korean spies just get picked up because their clothes are 10 years out of date. Like, they're very obvious. They don't know how much things cost.
Yeah.
Because everyone's so tight-knit in the North, the South Koreans can't really, like, the language they speak is different enough that they get pointed out as being, hey, this is a new guy here. And it's like,
yeah,
well, the borders are closed. How did the new guy get in?
Sticks out like a sore thumb, basically, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then the next one's in Kyoto, Japan.
yeah.
It's interesting. So this Otaku learns everything, but he's supremely disadvantaged when the power goes down because he's overweight. He can't really fight very well.
Because he's a, I forget the actual Japanese term.
Hikikomori.
Yeah, where he's stayed in his room for the most of his life.
Yeah.
I feel like this one's kind of
exploitative?
Yeah.
I mean,
I feel like Max Brooks knew that a bunch of
Otaku weebs would read this. Well, yeah, maybe because not weebs, but like, yeah.
Yeah, I think he was playing to his audience when he wrote this particular story. Just because this guy ends up being, like, a baller.
Yeah, like, he finds ends up, like, a samurai sword
and start, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, okay, alright, this is kind of exploitative, but okay, sure. It's not a very long section, though.
No. So, I feel like it wasn't really needed, because it doesn't really tell a super unique story.
No, it doesn't. It could like, it have been left out.
It doesn't add anything to the world building. It doesn't, you know, add any new information.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I think it's kind of a little ham-fisted.
Yeah. and then the last one is set in Sydney, Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And the character in it is an astronaut who was stranded in a space station during the entire thing. So he was safe, but he's dying in a hospital because of radiation exposure. So he was rescued by this private space tour craft,
mm-hmm.
probably SpaceX.
Let's be real.
and yeah, like I find that sad that like he had no threat of being killed by a zombie, but he's dying of radiation exposure because there's no one down there to get him down when everything was over. He just had to wait to be picked up.
Yeah. It's also interesting because another media does this, Why the Last Man.
Yeah.
Where there's basically a space station with men up there. Read the book, or the comic, it's good.
Yeah.
But yeah, it sort of explores this concept too.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, that draws from real world history in that there was a cosmonaut that when the Soviet Union fell, he was stuck
in
there was no chain of command because the government had fallen. So it was just like, okay, well, who gets this guy down?
Yeah. Who ended up getting them down?
I forget.
Oh, okay.
But I do know that did happen when the Soviet Union fell, that there was someone stuck in space.
Yeah. God, that's got to suck.
Yeah. Okay, so then we have Total War, which, like you said earlier, there's less and less of these sections I wanted to focus on because a lot of them do same repetition.
Yeah.
And
I will say, reading this as a second time, because I believe my first time I was really enthralled with it, but as the book progressed, I kind of got less and less invested. Into it. Yeah.
Um, So, Total War, 71 pages. There's only three sections I really want to talk about.
Yeah.
The first one is in Ainsworth, Nebraska. Focuses on the canine corps and the dachmunts that are used, which are little dachshund breeds that they can use to secure spaces. This section is so sad. The character in this has a dachshund that was his, partner, during the zombie war.
Mm-hmm.
And the dog is old now, so he has to, like, quiet it every now and then and make it comfortable or whatever.
Yeah.
But the handler mentions that there's a suicide rate that's higher in handlers because of the bond with the dogs. And I looked up, and that's actually true now.
Oh, really?
With military canine.
I did not know that. Yeah. I guess you get really attached with your animal.
Yeah, you get attached to your animal, and, you know, it doesn't live very long comparatively. So there's a high suicide rate.
Huh.
Did
not know that. That's interesting.
There's a pet shop story in here that...
Oh, yeah.
That is so sad. I'm pretty sure I can't relate it without choking up. But... Yeah. It's extremely sad, and, you know, honestly, all these descriptions of these graphic, horrific things happening to people in the previous sections didn't bother me, but for some reason, this pet shop story almost made me cry reading it. It's so sad. Hopefully you read it, and you know what I'm talking about. If you didn't, read that and be ready for having a miserable day.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely hit me, but I don't think I was almost about to choke up.
Yeah, no, it was, there's a huge lump in my throat reading it, and I'm just like, oh god, this is terrible.
Yeah.
So the next section is on the USS Holokai, offshore of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. It focuses on divers and mini-subs used to take out zombies underwater, because the zombies don't rot. Even in salt water, like you would expect them to.
Which is strange.
Interesting. Yeah, like, you would think that, because, like he says, salt water would break down the organs much quicker because it's coarse.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, they're affected by weather, being able to freeze and everything like that. You think that they would be affected by other, like, elements.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was kind of strange.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's... fiction, so.
Yeah. The last one is focused on Quebec, Canada, with a soldier for Underground Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about how they have to use hardwired radios to communicate with each other because that network of tunnels is so dense that, like, you can't use digital cell unwired walkie-talkies because there's no way to get the signal anywhere.
Yeah. That's kind of cool. Like, I would love to see those tunnels.
Yeah. Well, and he talks about how the gas masks they have to use severely limit what they can see because toxic fumes and sewage mean that you will die if you don't have a gas mask.
Yeah.
Which, again...
Because a lot of infrastructure breaks down when this, you know, the zombie outbreak happens.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Total War section is interesting, but it's, it repeats itself a lot. So the last section would be Goodbyes, which is just 17 pages.
Mm-hmm.
First one focuses on Kuzir and the Holy Russian Empire, which, again, like, if you've been keeping up, I don't believe that that's actually a thing. That's something that came out of... after the war.
Uh-huh.
And it focuses on women basically being used as breeding stock.
Because
of a lower general fertility rate because of malnutrition that happened during the war. Which...
is weird.
It's weird. The person who he's talking to seems proud to be contributing because she's actually... like, it's a way for her to actually get food as well.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I can see this happening in some countries.
Really?
Based on...
I just don't think people would kind of submit to that, but...
I think they would if they were starving.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. Again, like, it's disgusting. Like, I'm not...
You're not advocating
it. I'm not advocating it. I'm saying it seems realistic.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, even though it's gross. Yeah. So, then there's Bridgetown, Barbados. It focuses on a guy who is quote-unquote addicted to murder because of all the zombies he killed.
Yeah.
He says that when all the zombies are gone and he's no longer useful, he'll probably kill himself.
Yeah. That seems more reasonable. That seems,
yeah.
Like, that would happen during the zombie.
You just get used to murdering things.
Because, yeah. I mean, even when folks join the army, it's really hard for...
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. And it's interesting that he says he's addicted to murder because of it. Because, like, and that makes sense, like, if you're thinking of people, things that are former people,
mm-hmm.
I can totally see someone equating it to murder in their head because they look like a person.
Person, yeah. And it's really hard to disassociate with, like, if a good friend of mine turned into a zombie, it would be super hard for me to kill them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we go back to Manitoba, Canada, where the question is raised, why is X alive and my parents not? This is the girl that, or the woman, the person who was a girl when her parents left a hitchhiker out mm-hmm. somewhere or forced them out.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I'm sure that's a question that would get asked after something like this. Why is X person alive and Y person who's important to me not?
Yeah. Because, unfortunately, you know, decisions have to be made, and it's always a hard decision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Wenatchee, Washington, mm-hmm. a character talks about being at a bachelor party, and the people around him put on a pre-war porn. And the narrator says that he's envious watching this porn and stimulated by seeing a BMW Z4 and remarks that they're not ever going to make cars like that anymore.
Yeah. Because it seems like people are going to start making practical.
Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, your resources are depleted. There's mm-hmm. less free time to make these useless things, you know, like...
I mean, it sets you back years, like hundreds of years. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting commentary on something like that. Resources being wiped out. And so rather than watching the porn aspect of it, he's focused on this car that he'll never see one of ever again. Go back to Tel Aviv, Israel. There's a statement that, let's see. Yeah, so it's the spy master talking again, and he makes a statement that no one survived the Holocaust. Even if you were alive, you were so damaged and broken.
No.
If that's true, then no one survived on Earth after the zombie war. Which, it's an interesting statement.
It is a very interesting statement. I mean, it's strange that he pulls into the Holocaust. I feel like he could have probably made another reference to something else, but I can see what he's going at.
He's an Israeli intelligence official. Like, I feel True. Like he would, that's the comparison he would
draw. That's the reference he would make, yeah.
And then the last one is aboard the USS Tracy Bowden. And the character's lamenting the loss of whales. And they say when people talk about losing humanity or innocence, tell it to the whales. So good juxtaposed with that last one. Like, no one gets out of this untouched.
Yeah. Which is really good.
Yeah. Everyone is affected and everyone's scarred.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a great place to end that on, I think.
Yeah.
So overall, I feel like this book is paced very well.
Hmm.
I think it feels like a real historical document.
Yeah, I will agree with you on that.
Downside, like we've said before, there's a lot of repetition in it.
Yeah. That's why I feel like the pacing isn't that great. But again, so when I first read it, I devoured that book.
Yeah.
I think I read it in like 2 days just because.
Yeah, I think when I was reading it for this, I read it in maybe... Yeah, like probably 3 or 4 because I was taking notes. But yeah, it's a quick read.
It is a quick read. Though on my second read, I did feel myself kind of motivating myself to read more in the middle. I do feel like it does start off so fast and hot and heavy and good that the middle part kind of drags a bit.
Sure, sure. I guess by pacing, I mean that, like... I understand that there's a lot of stuff in there to reiterate certain points.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of feel like the reason they're in there is so that if someone misses his point that's fairly nuanced in one of them,
yeah,
it's like, okay, here's this one, but different. To kind of get it for the like a casual reader who may not be thinking it, like reading it in the way that we're reading it right now.
Hmm.
But yeah, like I get that. My other negative is that I have had to do transcription before. For like when I was in grad school, part of counseling courses.
Yeah.
If you're doing sessions, part of assignments were to transcribe your notes so that, because there's a format you have to follow so that you have your records and everything's standardized. Right. Having done that, people do not talk this way.
Yeah, but again, I don't think he was writing it.
Yeah,
a technical document. It's more written in a way of people.
Yeah, I get
reading
that.
It and it being a story.
Well, yeah, no, and I get that 100%. I'm just saying that people do not speak in complete sentences. There's a lot of moving around. There's a lot, especially when you're talking about traumatic experiences.
And
there's a lot of ducking and weaving and talking around certain things, and I
understand that, but I think
and I get what you're saying there. Like I understand he has to do it so that it's readable for a wide audience.
Yeah, and it's digestible, and people can sort of understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Where if you were writing it in a technical way, it'd be much harder probably to read and to get an understanding. Because, again, it would just be transcripts of people not having complete sentences or kind of ducking the situation.
Yeah.
But with my one little gripe, I really do like the book. I think it's very accessible. I feel like it's a unique spin on a genre that was just fresh in people's minds.
Yeah.
I know if you're kind of burnt out on zombies, it might not be the best thing to read.
Sure.
Just because it's going to hit a lot of those same points that a lot of zombie movies have hit.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like...
Because it's safe. It doesn't really, like...
It doesn't stray very far. I can see this being... viewed like in the genre as maybe a foundational text for like popular consumption, because you could basically, which we'll talk about the movie in a second, but you could spin a movie out of some of these longer stories very easily.
And I think that's the reason why I liked it so much my first read, because I read it when it first came out. And it wasn't an oversaturation of zombie media.
Yeah.
Now, reading it, a couple of weeks ago, I've had all of this zombie media that I've seen, that I've listened to, that I've watched. And, again, it's safe. It doesn't take any weird, deviant turns that I wouldn't expect. So maybe that's why I felt like it dragged on a little bit. When, on my first reading... I was super into it.
Yeah. So what would you grade this as?
I would grade it probably a B minus at the moment. Maybe if I was grading it when I first read it, when it first came out, I would probably give it a little bit higher, but I do think that's good. I do think that people should give it a read. I would recommend it.
Okay, yeah, I definitely recommend it.
Yeah.
I graded it at a C+.
C+?
It's, like you said, it's right now fairly standard old hat. It's still good. I would recommend reading it.
Yeah, and the thing is, again, I said it's very accessible. It's a quick read.
Yeah.
I don't think that you would be bogged down or the... Not to say the common person doesn't read that much, but like a person
the common person doesn't read that much.
I like to think that people read. But if like you read maybe 3 books a year.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a book that you could pick up and read. And oh, be yeah, like, yeah, yeah. Oh, okay, this is a light book. I don't think it's like Beowulf or some of the other books that we read.
Sure.
That where it's very intense and you really have to do some diving into the book, into the literature, into the author.
Yeah.
I think, again, this is something that you can pick up, you can read, you can finish it in a fair amount of time and be like, oh, okay, I was entertained.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I would grade it at a C+.
Okay.
Like I said, I recommend it.
Yeah.
Again.
So on the topic of zombies.
Yeah.
Then we'll get to the movie.
Sure.
So what are your feelings on, like, if the zombie apocalypse does happen? Do you feel like you would be prepared, or if you...
Oh, absolutely not. I'd be dead.
Okay.
I'd be dead in a week. I'd be lucky to last a week, if I'm being honest.
Would you actually kind of be happy about that, where you didn't have to deal with
I wouldn't want to live through it, no.
I mean, that scarring, it does, at the very end, it does sort of give a good indication of, like, you're scarred. This is never going to heal.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, generations will never heal from it.
Well, like, I'm just thinking, and it's like, I have a shitty car that does not have 4-wheel drive. I don't have a gun.
I don't have a gun either.
I was in but the boy, Boy Scouts,
you could be an otaku and get yourself a samurai sword.
I
lose that weight and be Boy a cool Scouts, that kid.
But I don't remember anything really. Yeah. Yeah. How about you? Do you feel like you'd survive?
I want to be boisterous and say yes, I would survive.
Okay.
But I'm probably giving myself like 70-30 survival.
Okay.
But I don't know. I do think, though, if it actually happened in this universe, people would recognize it super quickly.
Oh, yeah, because we have so much zombie media. People would just be like, oh, head, yeah, done, headshot.
It's a zombie, so... I don't think it would be as critical as a lot of these other zombie medias show, just because we'd be like, oh, yeah, that's what you got to do, and we can deal with this.
Yeah.
It would, yeah. So, the movie?
Yeah, so the movie, my plus is that it's a fun movie and it's engrossing.
But it is.
My minus is that it isn't World War Z the novel.
It is not.
It's this movie, this book, as it is written, is unfilmable. Like,
yeah.
The fact that they got a somewhat entertaining movie out of it, it speaks very well, I think, of the screenwriters.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it's just a zombie movie. It's an atypical zombie movie.
Yeah. The zombies in it are like swarms of ants.
Yeah.
Where they're
like piling on top of each other to get over like a wall.
They run.
They run. They don't shamble.
And it follows
a reporter, right?
Yeah, he's a UN reporter.
Yeah,
and in order to keep his family safe on a military ship out in the middle of the ocean, where they're not going to get attacked, he agrees to try and find the source and try and find a cure of it, because he's very good being a UN combat reporter in being in dangerous situations and keeping a cool head. And
which has nothing to do with this book, except that he's a reporter and the main character is a reporter.
Yeah, because, I mean, this book is set probably, 10 years after?
Yeah.
It's long enough after that some form of infrastructure is being kind of
rebuilt and re-put
together.
Yeah.
The movie happens during the outbreak.
Yeah.
Starting at the very first, and then you know, it follows him along. I wouldn't mind. So there is a sequel coming to it. Did you know about that?
A sequel to the book?
No, a sequel to the movie.
The movie? They're going to call it World War Z 2.
Yeah.
God.
So that's a dumb name. They'll probably change it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind if it were like a 28 days, 28 weeks type situation.
I can't believe they're making a second movie.
Yeah.
Huh.
The weirdest part of it to me, because I don't really envision him as this type of director, even though his career started with making a sequel, David Fincher is directing it right now.
Huh. man, that's going to be weird.
That's going to be a weird movie. Again, yeah. Like, I feel like they're probably going to take from the, like, aftermath sections of the book.
I hope so.
To make, because I can see him putting together something.
I hope it's more of a story-driven movie than World War Z as an action-based one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope that it's more of, like, talking about these stories and things along those lines.
Sure.
Than, like, let me shoot the zombies and run away from the zombies.
Yeah.
And, jump my bike over the zombies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was that episode.
So, Stuart gives it 2 thumbs up. I would recommend it. My grading would be a B minus.
Yeah. C plus.
Zach gives it a C plus.
Yep. So we average out like between a C plus and a B minus. So yeah. I'm guessing like an 80.
But you would recommend it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Now the next book is one of your choosing.
That is correct.
Which we talked about a while ago, so I've read it.
Yeah. So it is Warbreakers by Brandon Samerson.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy this author, and I look forward to discussing it with you.
I look forward to discussing it, too, because I'm not a huge Brandon Sanderson fan.
Yes.
But we'll talk about that when the book comes up.
But I am going to take off my biasy glasses and put them to the side.
Okay.
Because that's what I do here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we do. So, yeah, the next book is Warbreaker by Brandon Sanderson.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I just recently got word back that we will be back again this year at 221 BCon.
Yeah, which is awesome.
Which is awesome. Thank you so much. Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
We
definitely appreciate the invitation back. Did not embarrass us. So.
Yeah. We did a good job. So they're willing to have us back for convention coverage.
Yeah. So if you see us there, hopefully you guys all plan on attending.
Yeah. But it's the first weekend of April.
Yeah.
Yeah.
First weekend of April. If you guys see us roaming around, definitely give us a holler.
Yeah. We'll see you guys there. Still got some feelers in the water about some other conventions, but right now 221 BCon is willing to have us back.
Yep.
And
so that is,
we'll be there first weekend of April.
Yep. Yeah, that is a confirmed.
Yeah. So, this is the last episode of what I'm calling season 2, based on the amount of episodes we have.
Season 2.
And that's it. So we'll see you guys next week with Atomic Blonde.
Yeah, for season 3.
Yeah. Start it off with a bang.
Bang.
In the meantime, you can get in contact with us via email at backrowsupershow@gmail.com.
That's right.
Facebook, where it's 4 separate words.
Yeah, check us out. We're always active on there. And
yeah.
We are doing, you know, nerd fights.
Yeah, we have Nerd Fight. It's a bracket where we take 2 properties or 2 iconic characters from a property and jam them together. And you guys vote to see who wins.
Yeah.
And we'll see about giving out prizes again. Apparently there was some disappointment that there were no prizes at the last one. So we may want to look at that.
Yeah.
Maybe having one for one random lucky winner.
Yeah.
I
think that's definitely doable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, we've got a couple of other things in the pipeline. So
yeah, we have Patreon we're talking about.
Yeah.
We're still ironing out details.
Yeah.
But yeah, that should be it on this end. Shoot us an email. Hit us up on Facebook. Catch us at 221 BCon.
Yeah. So again, you guys all have a great day. And I look forward to hearing from you guys.
Yeah, me too. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Let's go. 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 Let's